Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This episode of Thinking Sideways is not brought to you by Pip Pip and Cheerio. Instead, it's brought to you by CrimeCon. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. CrimeCon is happening again this year, 2018, on May 4th through 6th in Nashville, Tennessee. We're going to be there. There's going to be a bunch of other big-name podcasters and TV hosts and writers and crime investigators overall. So, you want to be there? So go to crimecon.com and use the promo code SIDEWAYS to get 10% off. Can't wait to see you there. This episode is also brought to you by Stitcher Premium. If you want to get the episodes early, 4 days early as a matter of fact, and you want to get them ad-free, you're welcome to do so by going to stitcher.com/thinkingsideways and signing up for Stitcher Premium. If you use the promo code SIDEWAYS, you will get 1 month free if you sign up for the 12-month plan. And by the way, there's also going to be some extra bonus content thrown in there once a month. So, it's a good times had by all. Go there, enjoy. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Thinking Sideways, the podcast. I am Devin, joined as usual by
Joe
and
Steve.
Today we're going to talk about a mystery.
Yeah.
Weird.
A disappearance, in fact.
Even weirder.
It's like true crime, kind of.
Crazy.
That actually is kind of crazy.
It's a celebration of CrimeCon, so yes. Yeah, we're going to talk about crimes for a little while.
Yeah.
That works for me.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the 1974, so super recent, disappearance of 17-year-old Amy Billig, who disappeared while hitchhiking to her father's office or art gallery or something.
His place of work.
Let's his place of work.
POW.
To his pal. There have been some reported leads over the past 40-some years about her whereabouts, but she has never been found, nor have any remains or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Quick warning. There is a moment of discussion on some sexually explicit stuff, so big and little ear warnings for that if that's not your jam.
Huge ear warnings too, you know, all sizes.
Yeah. And finally, before we hop in, I want to thank listener Christy for being the first person to suggest this mystery.
Hey, thank you, Christy.
If you've suggested something recently, you may have found that we started saying, oh yeah, it's on the list, and we might have stopped adding names to the list.
Well, so. I add them. So hey.
That's good for you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, these
Christy,
guys are lazy. They
send
don't.
In your self-addressed and stamped envelope, and we will return you your prize. We don't actually do that.
We don't.
Star.
Which is your self-addressed stamped envelope back to you.
From Portland, Oregon.
Empty.
Yeah, no, with a little junk mail tucked into it.
It's great. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody, you really want to suggest stories. It's fine. Let's start at the beginning, shall we?
Let's.
Amy was born on January 9th, 1957, to loving parents and a reportedly normal home. She had at least one brother. I've only ever seen reports of one brother, but...
I never even heard what his name is, actually.
I did see it, and I don't remember because he is such a small player.
Ryan or something.
He's such a small player in the story.
I read an article with him. It was an interview with him because he was only a couple years younger. Is still, I guess. I don't know. He's still a couple years younger. But I don't remember his name. I'm really sorry.
I'm sorry, dude, if you're listening.
Yeah, looking at really good research right off the top.
Well, it's not that important.
She was enrolled in high school at the time of her disappearance. Amy enjoyed music, including playing both the flute and the guitar. She was an avid reader and writer and was thinking about becoming an actress time
because
she was 17.
Exactly.
She was also a very dedicated vegetarian and generally described as kind of a flower child, free spirit, sort of empathetic.
So she was a child of the 60s.
That crap was a lot more popular back in those days. Yeah,
yeah, it was. Yeah. I'm not really clear how this works, the layout of the day that she disappeared. But on the day of her disappearance, which was a Tuesday, March 5th, 1974, she came home from school at noon for lunch, which sounds like it was the end of her day for that day. You know, she was a senior, so sometimes you get, you know, you have your half days because you stacked your courses that way. Sometimes,
well, depending on the school, it's almost treated like college where you do certain classes on certain days.
That's
and
what
so
I mean.
She might not
stacked
have had
your days.
A Tuesday,
yeah.
Thursday afternoon class.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Or she just was skipping and, you know,
being
her parents
teenager.
Were okay.
Yeah,
with that.
This was the early 70s, yeah. You know, like skip school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the worst that was going to happen? You can get a factory job. It's fine.
It's fine. Yeah. Yeah. You can still afford an entire house and to raise a family of four on your salary. It's fine. Anyway, it sounds like that was the end of her day was at noon. She was coming home for lunch. Maybe she was skipping the afternoon. I don't really know. It's never, ever explained what was happening on that afternoon. So
she was going to head off and do something with friends, apparently.
Later that day. Yeah. Yeah. Regardless, she went home on this Tuesday for lunch, and then she called her father, Ned, asking for some money, either to go hang out with her friends or for lunch. It's kind of reported both ways. There's an alternate telling that she basically was just, she just went straight to his office or art gallery.
I think they're one and the same.
Ned, it sounds like, played the trombone, trumpet, not trombone, and owned an art gallery. That was what he did.
So he did something trombone-y or artsy.
Yeah. Okay, she needed money and she called him and said, hey, can I come get some money? And he said, yeah, you have to come get it.
I'll play my trombone for a couple of minutes and I'll get it.
Yeah, you got to listen to me play. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had heard, by the way, just FYI, I think it was somebody on Reddit who said he lived in Miami. He said they actually knew where her address was. Where his place of work was, they're about a mile apart.
Yeah, it was not very far.
It was not far.
Yeah, she literally could have walked in 25 minutes.
So it's
15 minutes, Christ.
Yeah.
Well, me anyway.
Well, she was wearing heels.
So. Yeah.
Well, and it's not clear again if she did go home and then go to the art gallery or just was headed from school to the art gallery. Either way, she had called him for some money, started walking there, never showed up. This was pre-cell phone, you will remember. Some of you will remember pre-cell phone times.
Oh, yeah, really? We're old.
Oh, we will. All of us in this room.
Because we're all old.
Yep, that's true. But so I think her dad probably just assumed she didn't ended up not needing the money, so it's fine, I'll see her tonight.
Teenagers, you know, they do flake out sometimes.
They're fickle.
Yeah, or, you know, maybe she found a $20 bill in her pocket or something. You know, I mean, it's fine.
In those days, it would have been a $5 bill.
What? I mean, you know, she found some money in her jeans at home or something and decided, I don't need it.
Jerking your chain, Devin.
Yeah. Sorry. Anyway, like I said, didn't show up to pick up the money. She also didn't show up to hang out with her friends. And I think her friends probably called the house. Again, this is a really severely underreported part of this story. This whole...
How did it begin?
How it happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is kind of frustrating because I feel like there's a lot of details in there that would have been really helpful to know.
Yeah, I know. Like, I've never been totally clear on if her mother was at home when she arrived home or if she talked to her mother or any of that
stuff. Or what,
yeah.
Based on the stuff that her mother has said, I get the feeling that no.
mom was not home.
Yeah, I get the feeling that they don't really know if she went home or if she just was heading straight to the art gallery. Reportedly, she went home and changed her clothes from her school clothes to her going out clothes and then was walking to her father's gallery. But
that would
since
make sense.
She's the friends,
very close of the time, too.
Yeah. And the friends didn't, you know, I guess they must have called or something, but otherwise her parents found out that she hadn't shown up and they thought, oh, she's probably missing then.
Yeah.
And my sense is that they reported her missing in the appropriate time frame and that, you know, blah, 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 right? She was 17.
Yeah. So they reported her missing.
They did, yeah. And once that was kind of pushed out, some construction workers said that...
Of course it was.
They were working on her route from her home to the gallery, and they saw her walk past, which is why I think they figured she had gone home.
They must have been said, like city workers, because they just stand around anyway.
Yeah.
She
was wearing a denim miniskirt and cork heels, so they... I guess we're the last people to have seen her.
As a construction worker, you should be careful of just catcalling at every lady because it might be the last person she sees.
Yeah, it's true.
Mm-hmm. Then you're going to be guilty forever.
And I think I didn't mention this, but the road that she was walking down was a road called Main Highway in the neighborhood Coconut Grove, which is in Miami, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It's often reported that she was hitchhiking along the road, but you know, like Joe said, it was a mile.
It's not that far.
It wasn't
Why
that
bother hitchhiking?
Far. Yeah. You know, I know from reports from her brother, he said they hitchhiked around the neighborhood, and she particularly hitchhiked around the neighborhood all the time.
That's just what you did at that
time. Yeah, and her parents knew about it, and they were like, it's a friendly neighborhood, you know, it's safe, it's fine for you to hitchhike around the neighborhood. But again, it was only a mile, so I don't really know. Maybe the heels were uncomfortable. I've certainly been in that situation before where I put on some new shoes because I, you know, was feeling myself and then started walking and was like, oh my God.
Or maybe
this is the worst.
Or maybe she's walking down the road and somebody she knew just stopped by and said, hey, Amy, want to ride?
Or even somebody she didn't know just pulled over and said, hey, do you want to ride down the road? And she was okay.
This is the era when truckers are not scary.
Yeah.
They are, you know, your long haul taxi service.
Yeah. So a search at this point is conducted. It didn't come up with anything. The family and the people who knew Amy didn't feel like she had just left voluntarily, like she hadn't run away from home.
For the circus.
For instance, yeah. And as far as I can tell, the police seem to have done their job, though again, if this story is starting to sound familiar to you and you don't really know why that is, it's because it was an episode of Unsolved Mysteries.
Really?
And as happens with these cases, it ends up that most of the reporting is kind of whatever was in that episode.
A lot of people report that stuff as being fact.
Yeah. Well, not only is it fact, but it also means that if they leave out big chunks of the story, those big chunks of the story tend to get lost to history.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know a whole lot about the initial investigation because Unsolved Mysteries didn't seem to give a hoot about it.
How many times have we talked about that?
We talk about it a lot. So
this is where actually you can actually be well served to get off the internet and go to your library and actually get a book about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Or
I've done that in the past. You find a lot of stuff that you just can't find on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise look at newspaper articles.
Oh, yeah.
Or something like that is really, really great. I found a couple of newspaper articles that we had used the Wayback Machine for this one. That was helpful, but they were still from, you know, the early 2000s. So nothing really from, well, there was one from like 95, but
well,
nothing
I was gonna
from
say,
the
even,
time.
Even some of the older stuff that I found was very thin.
Yeah.
Because this was the time when kids started disappearing and they just ran away.
Yeah.
The reporting was
especially
always
at,
very light.
Especially at 17.
Yeah.
You know, I think police often felt like, well, they just, you know, they went away and whatever.
Yeah, she met a boy and she chased him and sorry, mom and dad, but she's off happily living with the new boyfriend.
Yeah. But like I said, it does appear that the police did their job. There was a lot of reporting, at least in the Florida area, about her disappearance. A few days after her disappearance, a man who had heard about Amy's disappearance, I'm sorry I keep saying disappearance, turned in a camera.
Start using the word evaporation.
Okay.
I like that. Yeah.
Evacuation, maybe. A man who had heard about Amy being missing turned in her camera, which he said he had found near the Wildwood exit off the Florida Turnpike.
I've always wondered about the camera thing. Was it like, was it labeled?
It actually was, yeah.
Oh, was it labeled?
It was right below the, under the lens. She had, Kodak? Her name was written. Or something. Okay. Yeah. But it actually was.
Kodak keeps losing her camera, though. Yeah.
No. What?
No.
But
probably used one of those sticker machines that embossed your
name. The one like Bart Simpson had in that episode. Mm-hmm. Remember that one? Yeah.
But for those of you who are not familiar with Florida, so like everybody, even most people who live in Florida.
Absolutely.
That exit of the turnpike is about 50 miles north of Orlando, Florida, which means that the camera was about 272 miles away from Coconut Grove. So it's not like, whoops, on the way to the gallery, she dropped her camera. It's a big old drive.
Well, there's a perfectly innocent explanation. She probably pawned the camera because she did want money.
Yep.
She pawned the camera.
Because she was running away. Sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, and this does come with the caveat that it's really unclear if Amy had her camera with her when she disappeared or if it had even maybe been stolen prior. Her parents, it sounds like, couldn't say, for a couple of weeks even, that they had seen Amy with the camera. So, maybe she did pawn it because she was 17 and felt like she needed more money.
She probably didn't pawn it.
Maybe somebody stole it from her a couple weeks before, but also maybe it was.
Or she loaned it to somebody or God knows what.
Or maybe it was connected to the disappearance. It's almost impossible to tell. 3 weeks after Amy went missing, Amy's mom, Susan Sue. I'm calling her Sue the entire time, but I don't really know.
I think she goes by
really
Sue,
sorry.
Or went by Sue. I guess she's dead now.
Yeah,
but
she did pass away, but sorry if that's not it. Anyway, Sue got a call in the middle of the night, or I guess the Billigs did.
Ned and Sue.
Yeah, both of them have passed away, but Ned passed away in 1993. When the call started, they were both living together. Sue answered the phone, but it was dead air on the other end, so she hung up.
In other words, nobody there, not even the breathing.
Well, somebody there. No, it was breathing. Breathing.
She could hear the breathing?
She didn't say she could hear the breathing, but it wasn't just like dial tone or anything like that.
Okay.
So after she hung up, a few minutes after that, the phone rang again. She answered, dead air. A few minutes after that, when Sue answered the phone because it was ringing again, she was pretty sure at this point that it was Amy calling.
From beyond the grave?
No, just like, to say, Mom, I love you, I'm safe, or something. I mean, anything.
Or Mom, trying come to save me, come help
right,
me.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So Sue started to plea with Amy. She was asking her to come home.
That's who she believes is on the phone.
Yeah, she's telling her she loves her, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This goes on for almost 5 minutes, at which point Sue decides, okay, she's not going to say anything, right? Amy's not going to say anything. I'm going to hang up. So she hangs up. And this goes on for a few weeks before the police get involved, which they did, which again leads me to believe the police were really doing their job.
Oh, yeah.
They started
Florida. The police have to be on the ball down there. Right?
They sure don't.
Yeah.
So when they did get involved, they started tracing the calls and found they were coming from a phone booth, which they started staking out. Once they started their surveillance on this phone booth, however, the phone calls started coming from a different telephone booth.
How convenient.
Yeah, interesting. I know somebody must have had an in at the police department or something.
Yeah, this game of cat and mouse went on for a while, and Sue was getting these, silent calls.
They were able to kind of figure out there was, four or five phone booths who the caller was.
Yeah, certain kind of radius.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much like there were four or five and they would stake one out and then they would still all the while still tracing calls and it'd be coming and the call would come from a different phone booth and they were just like, oh my God, what?
But obviously this is not a big enough profile case to send cops to every one
of
them.
Well, I don't think they had the resources.
It would take them months to make a call sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. They couldn't just stake it out.
Probably what it was is they were staking it out and then the caller would just walk up and put up one of those sandwich signs nearby where they could see it that said free donuts and down the block or something.
No.
Yeah.
No, I know what actually happened. Let's continue here.
Okay. Fine.
After 5 months of silent calls, the caller finally spoke. So Sue was getting these calls couple night at least pretty consistently at this point that were just silence for 5 months. And then finally the caller did identify himself as Hal Johnson and told Sue, I have her. These calls continued for years, like we said, while the police continued to search for Hal. They could not figure out which one of the booths he was going to make a call from. And as we said...
How long would she be on the phone with him? A minute?
A couple minutes. Sometimes it depends. She said, you know, when the silent ones were happening, she would sometimes sit on the phone for 5 minutes of dead air. Like literally 5 minutes of dead air. But it seemed like she was always the one who hung up. It wasn't him, usually. So I don't really know.
It just seems to me like what they should have done was put in a second line. And then when he calls, just call the police right away. They just go hit all those phone booths all at once, you know, and just bam, nab them.
You would think, but so here
not
was the thing.
Not a high-profile case. They're not going to do that.
Well,
why not? They were staking it out. There was a lot of trouble. They went to a lot of trouble.
In the very beginning, yes. Yeah. But I have a feeling that by this point, enough time had gone by that they had given up.
Well, so, I mean, they were also starting to suspect that Hal was able to identify their undercover cars. Mm-hmm. Because clearly, you know, they would stake out any given one and it just happened that he wasn't using that one. Mm-hmm. That's absurd. Yeah. They also, the other thing that's important here for people to know is that some nights Hal would call Sue literally like dozens of times in a given night, and then he would go months, sometimes like, you know, 5 months, 6 months without calling her at all. So there was no real rhyme or reason, except for that whenever Sue was in the news locally, she could pretty much
guarantee
that Hal was going to call her.
He said some pretty horrible stuff too.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of not nice. Yeah. What happened is the calls escalated, right? So we said for a good 5 months, there was silence. Then for a couple months, he would just kind of say, I have her and, you know, whatever. Then he told Sue that Amy was learning quickly and that she was his sex slave.
Just what a mother wants to hear.
Yeah. He got really, really explicit and like a little weird. Some choice quotes from him include, I've smoothed her out. She knows just how to please. And I can tell you she knows how to use her mouth just in the right way.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Sorry. Again, just what a parent wants to hear.
Yeah. He eventually started tracing her movements even. He said that he was loaning Amy out to other men. He said that eventually he had, quote, sold her to the ragheads in Saudi Arabia, unquote.
And that's his quote.
His quote, not mine.
Sorry.
Where she had, quote, perfected her art, unquote.
Sorry about that, too.
I'm sorry about all of this. He detailed really awful things that are way worse than anything I'd ever want to say on this podcast. And these calls continued until 1993, which is 19 years of him just saying horrible, horrible, awful things. Mm. In 1993... it changed. You may remember we mentioned a few minutes ago that Ned, Sue's husband and Amy's father, passed away.
He died that year, didn't he?
In 1993. At which point, after Ned passed away, Hal, the first call that Sue got from Hal after Ned passed away was, he said, "You're all alone now, aren't you? You better watch your back."
Mm-hmm. Nice guy, again.
And then he started to detail some more stuff, basically saying that Hal said, "We want you," because apparently he was part of some, like, organization. I don't really know. But basically they, quote-unquote, wanted Sue to join Amy because they'd gotten tired of Amy's age, which would have been 36 at the time.
Amy's age?
Yep.
Oh, I guess she would have been 36.
She would have been 36 at that time.
Yeah, it really took that long.
That's right, it was 20 years.
Yeah, it was 20 years, yeah. So he said that everybody had gotten tired of how old Amy was, so they wanted a mother-daughter duo, and they wanted it to be Sue and Amy.
So Amy's too old, so mommy will make it better?
Right, okay. I don't really know. I don't really want to go into where that goes in the brain.
That's mostly an a-hole just jerking her around.
Oh, God, it's really awful. Anyways, the FBI got involved at this point and helped the police track the person who had been making these calls, because you may or may not remember, 20 years is a long time, especially in this time period and especially as it pertains to technology. So as Hal had started making these phone calls at phone booths, cell phones became a thing and he started calling from a cell phone.
Smart move, dude.
Yeah.
I'll never trace this.
Well, so the thing that's really interesting here is... they almost might not have. The FBI used some... It was a couple more years before the technology really, really caught up to the technology that Hal was using. But they finally were able to trace the cell phone number that Hal had been using for the last couple of years. Which, again, remember, tracing technology, all of that sort of stuff, that takes a while to catch up. So cell phones were a thing.
In the world, it's a slow process.
Yeah, so cell phones were a thing for a while before anybody could be tracing cell phones. The FBI was able to trace this cell phone number to an address, which the police went to check out. And it turns out the address was a federal drop site linked to the U.S. Customs. I know.
A federal drop site as in, what do you mean by drop site? Like a mailbox maybe?
No, I think it was just like a dead drop site. Like, you know, something that somebody would use to like drop off some packages behind a locked door or whatever. It's never really gone into. I'm just making an assumption here. But it was a physical address
of something. Yeah. Okay.
So,
all right.
So the police supervisor at this point, you know, the FBI says, okay, well, we linked it to this address, go check it out. And the police go to check out the address and find out that it's this U.S. Customs thing. So the police supervisor calls the branch of the U.S. Customs that was registered to this. I don't know how he figured it out, but anyway. And he says, hey, I have this phone number I'm trying to trace. Can you tell me who it's linked to? And the supervisor says...
Take off, eh? Get out of here, you hosa.
He says, none of your bleep bleep business, which I know.
You gotta love those feds, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the police decide, you know what? We know what will make the supervisor cooperate. And that is we have a number of tape recordings that Sue took with the approval of a judge. A judge, years earlier had said, yeah, you can record these messages for perpetuity or for, you know, voice recognition or whatever.
So they played them for the supervisor.
So they took them down
to
the office.
Is this one of
it wasn't even
employees?
Just a, like, you're recognized, was it? It was just like a, listen to all of the really messed up stuff that this person has been dealing with for 20 years and recognize that a lot of them have been coming to a phone number registered to an address that you're in charge of. At that point, the supervisor said, okay.
Well, didn't he say something like he called somebody else and he's like, I think I know who this is. It can't really be him, but I'm going to get so-and-so to come listen too. Like they had multiple people listen to it because they couldn't believe it.
Right. But basically he just said, okay, yes, I'll cooperate. Yeah. You're right. It is your business.
My bad. Yeah.
And now we're going to talk about theories because I bet you want to know who that might have been on the tape.
Bad, bad man.
We do want to know this. All right.
It was Hank Blair is our first theory.
Okay.
It was Hank Blair. Yeah, so that's actually what happened is the supervisor said, boy, I hope that's not Hank Blair, but it sure sounds a lot like Hank Blair. Yeah.
Just so you know, Hank talks to me just that way. He says, yeah, I got your daughter. I smoothed her out.
Yeah. Henry Johnson Blair is actually his full name. Come on.
Mm.
Didn't change your name very much,
Johnson.
Did you?
Yeah, this guy is like not, he was not careful at all.
No.
Yeah.
He was he's still alive. A U.S. Customs squad leader. Well, he was. I'm sorry. He was a U.S. Customs squad leader. He is no longer a U.S. Customs squad leader. He is alive still. He had more than 24 years of law enforcement service under his belt.
So that meant that he started his pervy phone calls when he was like, you know, kind of a rookie police officer.
He was 27.
Uh-huh.
He was actually he was an air marshal at that time. Which we'll talk about in just a second here. I just want to run through his kind of
makes you wonder about, do they give the air marshals any like psychological testing or anything like
they
that?
Probably do.
Do
now.
They give police?
Maybe
do
they
give
picky.
Police and U.S. Customs people psychological testing? Probably.
I thought they did.
But I mean, you know, people can pass this stuff. It's fine. Yeah. He was highly decorated for breaking lots of different smuggling rings in Miami. Recovered lots of stolen masterpieces for the government of Spain. He owned a house in the suburbs. He was, you know, your typical like high-ranking government law enforcement official.
High-ranking middle management, at least.
Yep. He was at the time 48 years old. He, his wife was a top administrator at the South Miami Hospital. He apparently didn't even have a speeding ticket on his record. That's how clean he was.
Well, he probably pulled out his badge every time he got pulled over instead of unofficial business.
Yeah.
So his law enforcement background obviously probably aided him in spotting these stakeouts at the
phone
booth.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. He had two daughters. One was 20 and one was 17. He was basically everybody, you know, he was that guy when the police came to take him away.
Nobody
in handcuffs,
suspected.
Everybody said, oh, he's such a nice guy.
Uh-huh.
But he was always such a nice, quiet guy.
Mm.
But there you go. He was arrested pretty much on site at the U.S. Customs. He was in the office at the time, and they just handcuffed him and took him away because a bunch of people identified his voice. And he initially admitted to had been calling Sue for 3 years prior, which I gather is about
how long. The last 3 years of the calls.
Yeah, which is what I believe is how long that cell phone had been active and had been issued to him.
So he didn't admit to the phone booth calls then?
No, so, you know, and that makes sense to me, right? He said, well, I've had the cell phone for 3 years, so they know for sure. If I was doing it now, I was
he
doing
it
3 years
it
ago. All right, he knows how it works. So he says, yeah, yep, 3 years ago. Then during questioning, he admitted to the additional 17 years. So it was 20 years altogether.
What makes me curious about this guy is, did he do this to anybody else, or was it exclusively Sue Billig that
I don't
he made
know.
The calls to?
I don't know the answer to that.
And he will probably not tell.
No.
For good reason.
Yeah, so when he lawyered up, because you lawyer up, his lawyers actually said they were entering a plea of not guilty to the two counts of felony stalking.
Well, you know, if I were his lawyers, I would use the big phone defense.
Mm.
Yeah, big phone.
His lawyers decided to do something even
almost
skeezier.
Even more shameless.
Even more awful. And
disgusting, maybe even.
And claim that the calls between Hank and Sue were consensual.
You're going to have to explain that in this theory, because that took me a long time to wrap my head around, and I had to do a lot of reading on it.
Well, I think probably the theory is, let's put on my shameless hat here, probably. You know, he called and she stayed on the phone and didn't just hang it right up. And so
she
he took
answered
that,
the phone, so it's consensual?
She answered the phone. That's not consensual, but she stayed on the phone is probably what the lawyer said. Well, if she didn't like the phone calls, why didn't she just hang it up? Instead, she just stayed on the phone and listened to his stuff. That's probably what the... I'm not saying.
I know you're not agreeing with
here,
it. You're probably right, and that
probably
is what they said.
Or she might have even said, if she really believed that there was the tiniest shred of hope that this guy actually had her and maybe someday would give her back, she might have said something on the order of, you know, please call me again. You know, I mean, because, you know, that was the only hope that she had.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think... their argument, was basically that, yes, Hank was making these kind of stalking and, like, really kind of sexual, like, bordering on sexual assault calls.
Mm.
Like, what he was saying to her was so really awful and explicit, but it was almost always of, like, a pretty explicit sexual nature.
Mm.
And I suspect that, you know, that was part of the prosecution was saying, like, look at all the really messed up things he said. And the defense was like, no, that was part of the game for her.
She
enjoyed it. She got
off
on
it. She enjoyed it. Or else she wouldn't have kept answering.
Right.
She knew better.
Right. Even though the entire time the character of Hal in Hank continued to say, I have her, I have your daughter. And that was the only hope. I'm sorry. I shouldn't go too far into this because it's just like, it's so disgusting.
He's a real Jekyll and Hyde, though.
Yeah.
If you think about it, I mean, during the day, he's the mild-mannered, law-abiding, law-enforcing good guy.
Yeah.
And then at night, he's the evil, evil creep.
Well, so he actually, he said in his admittance to guilt to the police, he said... You know, it would just build in him.
Sort of obsessive compulsive.
He would get the urge to like call her and he could like suppress it for a certain amount of time. And it would just build and build and build. And then he would call her like a couple times a night. And by the end of the call session, it would be like relieved. Mm. So it was a compulsion of some kind.
Yeah.
It sounds like still kind of
still
messed up.
Yeah, it's creepy compulsion. Yeah. This is something that, you know, thankfully, really, I can't get away with. I can't do this. I could just picture I'm making my pervy call,
mm-hmm.
and then there's this pause. He says, wait a minute. I know your voice. You're that podcast guy.
And you go, oh, no, no.
Oh, no, no. I don't know what you're talking. I don't even know what a podcast is.
What's
goodbye.
A podcast?
So I can't do that.
No, you can't.
And I don't have cats either.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yeah. And so on the face of this, right, we can pretty much say, well, he's a creep and a but he wasn't able to provide any information about Amy that he couldn't have read in the papers, which is true. And also the information that he said he provided about her was inaccurate. So he probably didn't kidnap her. So one of the things that I will just say here is that, you know, one of the things that Sue did, of course, was say like, okay, prove it to me. Like, tell me something that, that only you could know about Amy's body. If you do have her and she's your sex slave, mm-hmm. tell me something about her that only you could know.
Yeah.
And this is important because, Amy had a pretty gnarly appendectomy scar on her torso that information was never released. Well, I mean, it is now, but, you know, after 20 some years had still never been released
and
to the public.
And he never reported the appendectomy scar.
And he did not. He actually said her torso's smooth.
Mm-hmm. Well, he smoothed her out, right?
Right, he smoothed her out.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I don't know, whatever that meant. I don't know.
But no, I mean, so
obviously
even
he
then,
didn't know anything.
Right. But on the other hand, it's worth noting that there is a single mention of a Hank in Amy's diary from about 6 weeks before she disappeared. And it said, quote, Hank says as soon as I finish school, he wants to take me to South America with him. I told him he's crazy, unquote. Sue and pretty much everybody who was friends with Amy at the time doesn't recall there ever being a Hank ever. And granted, this is a one-off, well, like one time somebody mentions it.
If you're a 17-year-old girl, you're not going to tell your parents you're dating a guy who's 10 years older than you. Probably.
Well, but it's also that I mean, we've read about this in different stories before where when there's somebody that you don't necessarily want to admit that you're seeing or interested in, you give them a code name or a nickname. So Hank is somebody else entirely. Plus Hank isn't an uncommon name.
No.
So she could have literally known some kid in school who was named Hank saying, I'm going to go to South America and you should come with me, hot girl. Yeah. It would be awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like, you know, pretty much everybody from the area, you know, again, this is just a straw poll, right, of police kind of investigating. It's a small community, Coconut Grove.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, Miami's large, but Coconut Grove's fairly small, or at least was at the time. It was pretty close-knit. People said, well, I don't really remember there. I mean, I remember this Henry Johnson Blair guy who did actually kind of live in that area at the time, but I don't really remember a Hank. And the other part of that is, since he was the air marshal, he was actually assigned to South American roots, so he was spending a lot of time in South America at the time.
Yeah, so, maybe,
so I mean, they're little tiny things.
He might have known her. That doesn't necessarily mean that
he might have known her, and he might have known her and said he was going to take her to South America, and that was the end of that relationship because she was like, "Wow, you're actually crazy. You're 10 years older than me, and you're married." No, and she wrote about it in her journal, and that was that. And then she disappeared 6 weeks later, and you know, whatever. I don't put a lot of stock into this, but it is interesting.
The timeline for him and his marriage, though, don't exactly line up.
It almost exactly does. He had just gotten married
right before she disappeared.
He just got married, and literally like days before she disappeared, returned from his honeymoon.
Well, yeah. The timeline there is iffy. It's either he returned 2 days before she disappeared, or he returned the day after she disappeared, depending on where you find the timeline.
Depending on if you believe him or his wife.
You know, I mean, listen, I'm just saying that the timeline is not concrete.
Yeah, the way that I've seen it, and again, this could be totally wrong, the way that I've seen it is his reporting said, we got back from our honeymoon the day after.
Mm-hmm.
His wife's reporting, even though she seems to have stood by him during this entire time. He spent some time in jail and he's out and they're still together. But she said, no, we got back 2 days before she disappeared.
And I would say that she's probably the right one because women usually keep closer track of that stuff than guys do.
True.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's not, I don't know. He spent 2 years in jail for a lesser charge. He didn't get charged with the felony charges. He got charged with two counts of misdemeanor stalking, spent 2 years in jail, and then sued him and won a $5 million settlement.
I wonder how much that she ever collected.
I was going to say, I doubt she saw much of that.
Yeah,
she died just a few years after that.
It's so weird to sue an individual for amounts of money that large because there is no way they're ever going to be able to deliver.
Yeah, now, I mean, I can agree, but
you know, you've got this outstanding judgment against him. So anytime he makes any money, you know, your lawyers step in and take it. But you know,
okay. Yeah. So here's a question. So I know that debt is inheritable. Like I run up a bucket load of credit card debt and have a passel of kids and then keel over. And that that debt is can, you know, the credit card company can pass that on to the children.
No, they can't. I mean, they can take it out of your estate, I think.
No, they take it out of your estate. They don't
take
it.
They can't tag the kids with it.
Nope.
They can't?
Nope.
Okay, well, I know some debt is inheritable. And so my question is, would this kind of debt be inheritable?
It's inheritable in as much in that it can be taken out of your estate. So if your estate is worth $5 million and you're $2 million in debt, that comes out of...
They get the two and that's it.
Yeah.
That comes out of their inheritance, right? But it's my understanding that unless you take over like...
A mortgage maybe.
Right. So like if they inherited the house, you inherit that debt because you suddenly become the owner of a house. So you are paying off the mortgage. But it's my understanding. I could be wrong.
I was talking to somebody recently, and they were utterly convincing me that, oh yeah, if you know, I've got elderly family, and we were talking about debt, and they were saying, oh yeah, like if they wanted to, they could come after you with that debt.
I don't think that's possible.
Somehow like a co-signer on their debt or something.
We were talking about if the debt had gone bad, in, you know, I stopped paying on it for a year and then I die. Can they then turn that collection around?
I think they could take it out of the estate, maybe.
I'm sure we've got a lot of listeners who
would love to get emails that tell us the answer.
So you know, died a couple years after that settlement was handed down, but it felt like vindication, certainly. Like I said, I don't necessarily think that Hank kidnapped her or anything like that, but
he was just a Looney Tune sort of, you know, what are these guys? What do you call
There's
like
words
parasite,
to describe
you know?
Him that
like
are not
a,
nice.
Yeah, nothing but, I have to say about him is a nice thing. Next theory is a real quick one.
The twinsies?
Yeah, the twinsies. So just so everybody knows, a few days after Amy disappeared, 16-year-old twins Charles and Larry Glasser claimed to have kidnapped her. And they wanted $30,000 for her, which was a lot of money back then.
Still is a bit of money right now.
The police found out that they were lying, and then they were arrested for extortion. So
People do this on a regular basis.
That's why I take advantage of a situation. And that's another reason I'm thinking that old Henry there was probably not our perp.
Hank.
Because these cases always attract those kinds of people too. You know,
he was
Frank.
He was not a good man, but I don't. Oh. Yeah. Anyway, our next theory is the outlaws / the pagans /
the motorcycle
some motorcycle gang of some kind.
Yeah. This is there was, you know, I'm a little older than you guys. I remember there was sort of a biker gang scare back in, you know, I guess.
In the 70s?
Yeah. Yeah, there was. They were considered ultra scary.
And also they were considered, like, untouchable by police a lot of times.
I don't know why either.
So, there's a book about this that Sue co-authored before she passed away. If this is your pet case and you know a lot about this theory or you've read the book, or you're really interested in it, go read the book. We officially do not have any time to talk about the full breadth of that book.
Yeah, but we're going to... She went into great detail about her adventures, because she spent decades looking for her daughter.
She really, really did. And so we'll talk a little, we'll do like a really, like really high level overview of this theory. But if it strikes you as an interesting one, feel free to like do more research on it.
So, Devin, this theory sounds very familiar. Are you going to explain to people why, in a panic, this theory made you think that you knew this story already?
No.
Please do.
No.
Please share it.
You used to be a biker girl.
You can't get out of it now.
No. No, this is very similar because we've done another story that's a lot like this one. But we did it last time.
Devin sent me a panicked message. Oh, my God, have we done this story?
I did. It was like 2 days ago, too. I was like, it's too late to change. Oh, my God.
There are times when I'll be reading one of these things and I'm like, yeah, I'm ready to do this. Story. Wait a second. Did we do that a year or two ago? Yeah. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, we've been doing it for long enough where it's kind of like,
you just want to make sure.
Listen, that list for the listeners out on the website is also for us to
use. It is. Oh, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
So, one of the other things that happened in Coconut Grove on March 5th, 1974, was a massive amount of bikers traveling through on their annual Bike Week tour. This tour took them from Coconut Grove through Coconut Grove, excuse me, up Main Highway, then onto the Florida Turnpike, and then up north, and then
and Main Highway was the route that she took to her dad's work, right?
Main Highway is the route that Amy was walking along to her father's work, and the Florida Turnpike is where her camera was found a few days later.
Right. So 270-some miles north.
Yeah. Sue got a tip 12 days after Amy's disappearance that somebody from the Outlaws biker gang had kidnapped her. She was able to arrange a meeting through a friend who had done some legal work for them, and it ended up being with two men, and with Amy and with Ned. I'm sorry, and with Sue and with Ned.
So for people who don't know, because I know we went into detail in the Lauren
Spear
episode, but Outlaw Biker Gang is technically classified as what is referred to as the 1% of bikers, the ones who are truly the outlaws and the lawbreakers who do not care and do what they want. They're not law-abiding citizens who also happen to own a motorcycle.
Yeah. They're the ones that proudly proclaim that they are part of the 1%
and they will do whatever.
Really gnarly bike gangs.
Yeah, and they will do whatever they want. They will. The police shoot them.
Yeah.
They're like Cartman. I do what I want.
Anyway, this meeting happened with Sue's friend and then Ned, Sue's husband, Amy's father.
Mm-hmm.
And two members of the outlaw gang and Sue as well. The men claimed to have not seen Amy personally, but they did confirm that other gang members had frequently kidnapped and sold young women in the past, which they called old ladies.
Mm.
You get that, right?
Yeah.
Am I the only one that gets that?
No, I get it. Yeah. It's just like...
Okay.
Anyway, they often were sold or exchanged for like a credit card or even like a bike. One woman came forward and said that she had been an old lady for the Outlaws for a while, and she was one time traded for a pair of chaps.
That's got to be good for your self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Huh?
In according to the stories in that culture, it's women were property. Much mm-hmm. like you would see hundreds, if not thousands of years ago, where you traded them for stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying that's right, but that's what this is saying.
And so these two men said they would ask other members about Amy. They never really were able to provide any kind of concrete information.
Yeah, there was a lot of context that Sue had like this. Mm-hmm. Everybody's saying, yeah, I think I heard something about it. I'll get back to you. And then and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But what I want to know, and obviously you can't answer it. Nobody really can. Is this tip that Sue got that somebody from the Outlaws had kidnapped her. Was this a hard tip, or was this just somebody who speculated and was thinking, hey, you know, the bikers are going through town that day. I bet, you don't know how solid this tip really is.
Well, it may have been solid because Sue did follow up a little bit here. In 1985, so 10, 11 years later, a member of the Outlaws named Paul Branch called Sue and said that he had been in quote-unquote possession.
You mean the Pagans?
Outlaws.
I was going to ask here because I've seen
Pagans and Outlaws, and I frankly, offense to all of you 1% or biker listeners, it's all the same.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask because I couldn't.
God, they're going to come
really
and kill
get
me.
Straight. Mm. Well, hey,
now those guys are all pretty old.
This file
right
is geotagged to Joe's house.
True.
So we're safe.
It's true. No, I pretty much just assume it was the Outlaws because most of the reporting I've seen is the Outlaws.
Okay.
But I think it's just kind of like Bike Week, it sounds like, is just like all of the 1%er bike gangs are going through together.
Yeah.
And or at least the ones that get along. And so it's kind of amorphous on who actually it was. But I'm going to just keep saying they were the Outlaws. So
okay.
Paul Branch.
As a general brand.
Paul Branch, I think, was a member for sure of the Outlaws. He called Sue or otherwise contacted her and said that he had been quote unquote in possession of Amy in Orlando for a while. He said that he bought her off of someone and that he had treated her well, but that when he bought her,
she'd been kind of rough around the edges.
She'd been roughed up a bit, beat up a bit. In general, claims like this would be brushed off, but he was apparently able to identify that scar that we talked about a little earlier on Amy's abdomen from the appendectomy. And again, this was way before anybody would have known that, really.
My only questioning of that is that if she says, well, can you identify any special marks on her body? What I would say, if I were asked that question and I was just full of BS, I would say, well, she had an appendectomy scar.
Yeah,
because so there's a good chance she does.
So this is actually also the guy, you might have read this in the reading. I didn't write down the number, but Sue was offering a fairly sizable reward.
Oh yeah.
Basically the buying power of like $5,000. And when Paul Branch contacted Sue, he said, I don't want the money.
Yeah.
I just want you to know what I think I know.
Yeah.
So I do lend a little credence. Again, I don't really know. I think appendectomy scars they're not so uncommon, especially in those days.
They're very common.
They're pretty common, so it's totally possible that it was a different girl altogether.
It's also very possible to say, what are common things that you see on somebody who has had any... When a parent says, well, can you tell me this? Any identifying features... scars,
birthmarks,
moles, and birthmarks.
Yeah.
These are the three go-tos. And you can say, well, there was that birthmark, and they say nothing. You go, wait, no, it wasn't a birthmark. Was it a mole?
Right. So there are ways.
Wait, was it a scar? Oh, right. A scar!
So there are ways for him to have gamed the system. But again, he didn't want the money. So it's like, to what end
the system? Let's go back to Hank. Let's go back to Henry for a second.
It's totally different.
Oh, no, I'm not saying it's the same thing, but I'm saying that somebody can actually be totally full of it.
Absolutely.
You know, as Henry
but
was.
It's totally still, different to... You know, it doesn't really matter. The whole thing here is that it might have been true that she was in Orlando for a while. The reason that also gives this a little bit of steam is that when Sue did track her there after talking to Paul Branch and kind of connected with some people, because we talked about she did this like countrywide tour, Sue, over the years, trying to track Amy and the Outlaws, I guess. She questioned a ton of people in Orlando and kind of the surrounding area. And she actually found a convenience store manager who remembered seeing Amy, or at least a young woman, being escorted by at least two bikers on many occasions. The manager remembered one detail about this young woman, and that detail was that she always bought vegetarian vegetable soup, which is an important little factoid because you may remember that Amy was a dedicated vegetarian. Mm. The convenience store manager said she was never alone. She always had at least a couple people with her. She was always well guarded, blah, 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 blah. Whether or not this, I mean, you know, the Unsolved Mysteries episode, as mentioned about this case, they make a big deal about this and the Orlando lead
and Sue's
book makes a big deal about the Outlaws thing.
One of the questions I have about this, and you guys maybe can answer this, is that I go to convenience stores, but I'm always there to buy like beer and chips. And so I have no idea if convenience stores even sell soup. Do they?
Yeah, they do.
It depends on the if it's not a chain convenience store. So if we roll back the clock 20, 30 years. You could go down to the whatever Quickie Mart. Don't give me that look, Devin. It was much more prevalent back in the day.
Like a mom and pop shop?
Yeah, the mom and pop kind of
shop. I'm giving you that look because literally every convenience store I've ever been in my entire life has always had at least a couple different cans of soup on the shelf.
Oh, no, see, no. Okay. I go to the 7-Eleven by my house.
Well, the 7-Eleven by your house is crappy.
And chips? Well, that's because the 7-Eleven.
I mean, the 7-Eleven by my old house used to have like five or six different kinds of soup.
Okay.
Brands and etc.
I've only seen it on the mom and pop shops.
Reason that it was interesting was, at least, you know, again, on the Unsolved Mysteries episode of this, they re-interviewed the convenience store clerk, and she said, the girl asked me if we had vegetarian soup.
Mm-hmm. Now, see,
and that at one point the woman said, well, we don't. But then got more.
I don't know. Interesting because... In other reporting, she's always described as, in this whole biker theory thing, as she was always docile and quiet, and there's, you know, these hints that maybe somebody cut her tongue out. So I find it, that's very opposite of
I think the sense that I got, at least again, from this, was the convenience store clerk was like, you know, she like very timidly said like, do you have this or whatever. I mean, you know, maybe, yeah, again, we just like this is.
Well, yeah, we don't know because it's such a.
Yeah.
Mishmash is the word I'm going to use.
Yeah.
There's so many conflicting accounts, especially in the quote unquote biker angle.
Well, I got to tell you too that going around, say, Orlando and showing Amy's picture and stuff like that, I have no, you know, you can always contaminate your witnesses too by just saying stuff. Did you ever see this woman? She might have been with some biker, some really scary biker guys, you know, and she was a vegetarian and then, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you don't really know how the quality of the interrogation that was going on here.
Oh, either. For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I kind of question anybody's memory if they think, like, what, how long had it been? Like 10 years, 5 years since this clerk had seen her?
Yeah, a couple of years probably at least.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine, seriously, unless you've got a photographic memory.
Yeah, so I think the at least the kidnapped biker gang theory is kind of like a red herring.
And held forever. Yeah. I could certainly see some other theory, but the problem I have with this theory is that, and the reason I think somebody just kidnapped her and killed her probably, is that, you know, I mean, they would have held her for decades. And it's like, in all that time, she would have definitely have had opportunities to get away or to at least pick up a phone and call the police or something.
Well, I mean, you know? I think that. That is kind of what the interview with the other biker gangs and the other women who were old ladies really speaks to, is that that's a thing. I mean, you can brainwash a person or intimidate them into feeling like they have no other option but to make you happy. And particularly if it is true that she was with Paul Branch for a while and he got her really, really beat up, it's, you know, and especially if her tongue had actually been cut out or anything like that, you know, it's not, I mean, it's, you just like get victimized. You can get so victimized that just lose your will or even thought.
Using the term brainwash is kind of a slippery slope because there,
like a Stockholm.
That's hard to, well, brainwash is hard to actually categorically say this is what it is.
Okay.
But
that's fair.
An actual tactic that people that are stealing people to put them into situations of sexual slavery do is they hook them on drugs. Once you make somebody an addict and you are the only source of their deal, they become very compliant and they do what you say when you say, and they don't fight back because they need their fix.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So I
personally think the long-term theory is just as viable as somebody stole her and shipped her overseas to be a slave in another country.
I would find that more believable.
That's pretty far-fetched.
Yeah. That's not far-fetched.
I do have a sub-theory on the Outlaws biker gang thing, and that is that it's possible that she had been picked up for a party. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if it was bike week, she's wearing a short little denim skirt and heels. She's 17. She's a pretty good looking young lady walking down the side of the highway. A biker pulls over and says, "Hey, baby, you want to go party?"
Yeah, maybe.
And she thinks, okay, sure.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. And gets on the back of a bike because there were some reports, again, however tainted, that she was seen on the back of a motorcycle. And, you know, they parked for the night, partied. Something bad happened. We're there. And she's now, you know, feeding the gate or was then feeding the gators. And
alligators eat people?
Oh, believe it or
not. I thought they only lived in sewers.
Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah. But that, you just keep believing that, Steve. But I mean,
that's why I don't go in the sewer. Okay?
I think that's possible that, you know, something kind of unfortunate like that happened.
That's more plausible, I think. Yeah.
You know, that. Yeah.
I think that's entirely possible. Or there's the random serial killer theory.
Yeah, so there's one final theory here, and that's the tan truck / jeep / van guy. Because there were a number of reports initially, not after the fact, just initially during the initial search, people said, oh yeah, I think I saw somebody who looked like Amy in a tan truck or van or jeep, you know, along main highway, along that route. Or getting in that, or, you know, whatever, somehow associated with something like that. And the only reason that that gives me even a little bit of pause is, you remember we talked about the camera that was found.
Yeah.
They developed the film, which you might have assumed, you were probably actually yelling, like, what did they do with the film? Yeah. And we were frustrating you.
They opened the camera up and they said, what's this? And they just pulled it
and
out.
And just pulled it out like a toddler with like a tape. Yeah. no, they developed it. And
oh, that's good.
Most of it was just way overexposed and like totally unidentifiable, whatever. But there was one picture that they could identify, which was a still pretty overexposed, but it was an overexposed picture of a tan truck against like a wall. And I have heard through, again, I don't know what the reporting really is, that maybe Hank Blair had a truck that looked kind of like that.
I've heard that story.
Or that looks kind of like that.
Yeah, that he had one. Although actually a lot of people had vans. A lot of people still do.
Yeah. Or trucks or Jeeps.
Do either of you know whatever became of the film from that roll of film? Here's my reason for asking is that.
Technology.
Yeah, you maybe. Can scan negatives and do some amazing stuff.
Maybe.
That, I mean, I was digging around in my attic. This was a couple of years back, and I found a bunch of old negatives. And some of them you could tell were people, and some you couldn't really tell what the hell they were. And if you put them into a film scanner, and then you run them through the gamut, you can pull an amazing amount of and make exceptional. You can see what there was because you can dial it back. There's a tonal control that you get digitally that you didn't get from analog film processing.
I don't know. You know, the thing about it is you would think that the film would still be somewhere in evidence. But, you know, on the other hand, the evidence does seem to get lost quite often.
It does, and film degrades. I mean, you know, if it wasn't stored properly.
Well, yeah, that's the hard part.
It could have just degraded. Somebody could have thought, well, there's no way that this is going to be relevant.
If anybody who's connected to it knows and they find that frickin' film, you need to get it to somebody who can scan it properly.
Us.
Yeah.
Send it to us. We'll solve the case.
Yeah.
Okay.
With film.
I'll buy. We got the money. I'll buy a film scanner.
Yeah,
I've always wanted one.
Right?
Yeah. I love film scanners.
We'll start a Kickstarter. It'll be great. That is the only other kind of theory that's out there that it just had something to do with this.
There is one other theory.
Okay.
Really?
Okay, yeah.
Is it Chupacabra?
No.
Is it aliens?
No, actually, it's not.
Is it?
It is. Are you ready?
Yes.
Pyramids?
No. The Rapture.
And she was the only one that was worthy. You're right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I think it was.
That's probably true.
Yeah, I think it was a rapture.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm down.
I got to be honest with you. This is one of the few times where I'm going to say none of the theories.
Why?
What do you think happened to her?
I mean, I don't think that it was the bikers. I don't think that it was any of the people who were described. Like, I mean, Van Guy is maybe the only thing, because I literally think that some unknown person picked her up, whether of her own volition or not, and drove away with her, and she is probably in a shallow grave somewhere.
Oh, no, that's what I think happened most likely, is that what it, but...
And which is horrible. I mean, thankfully, Sue doesn't have to hear us say that.
Yeah, but, and as far as the van, I mean, that picture might have been taken some other day. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, like I said, we don't know when the camera disappeared, if it disappeared with her, if it disappeared weeks or even months earlier.
But I'm with Steve on that. I think it most likely... I mean, you know, again, there's the whole picked up, taken to a party, killed, disposed of. That's possible too. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking most likely it was just some freak who picked her up, murdered her, and she's, you know, tossed her in the swamp somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, I just have to agree. I think, you know, unfortunately, again, with a lot of these disappearances, the most merciful thing is that that person, you know, maybe it was a really terrifying couple of hours after they got kidnapped. But really, honestly, I just often hope that.
Because that's better than the years of slavery.
Years, decades.
Yeah.
Decades of literal torture, right? I mean, so, you know, and I just tend to think if they weren't found, it's really likely, especially this long, that she just got killed one way or another within a couple days, if not a couple hours. And
one of the things I'm curious about is when did the Unsolved Mysteries segment air?
Oh, it was in the 90s at some point.
Okay, and so...
I guess it had to have been, like,
It was still rubber stacked.
It was between when Ned died, because Ned had passed away already.
Okay, so
and when Sue died, and she died in the late '90s, I think.
Okay. So I'm sure those things usually touch off a whole avalanche of tips.
Yeah, I don't think there was any. There were no updates or anything.
So that's one.
But
of
they broadcast anyway.
But that's another reason that I think, and that's I have not heard of anything, any sort of information being dislodged by the airing of that episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think if she were alive,
a lot of people would have seen her. A lot of bikers would have seen her, and other people would have seen her if she'd been held captive for all those decades.
I agree.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I think she's been dead for a long, long time
since about 1974. Yeah, I think. Yeah.
Well, if you want to see some of the research that we did for this case, or if you want to take a look at that episode list we talked about that keeps us sane, kind of, or you want links to merch, because we've got shirts and mugs and some other things, too.
Other swag.
Yeah. You can find all those things on our website. That website is thinkingsidewayspodcast.com. If you want to interact with us in any kind of social way, don't do that. That's creepy.
call Devin on the phone and just don't say anything.
Please don't do that. No, you can find us on actually all of the social medias at this point. You can find us on Twitter, where we're Thinking Sideways. You can find us on Reddit, where our subreddit is Thinking Sideways. You can find us on Facebook, where we've got a group and a page. So like the group, like the page, join the group. You have to answer 2 questions. They're super easy.
Yeah.
Just make sure you answer them
correctly.
It doesn't even have to be that correct.
I don't know. There's been some obviously not correct answers.
Fair enough.
Okay, what is it, like yes and maybe? Is that what that was?
It's yes and Thursday.
Oh, okay. Easy.
It's easy, yeah.
Okay.
And yet people get it wrong.
Oh, yeah, they get them real wrong. It's kind of fun, actually, to see some of the answers. Anyway, we also have an Instagram, and that is Thinking Sideways Podcast, not Thinking Sideways.
Yeah, not those other people.
No.
Who call themselves, lawsuit, you thinking, guys?
Yeah, I'm thinking.
Trademark infringement.
Yeah, I think so. But anyway, yes.
Not that they had it first or anything.
Yeah.
It's Thinking Sideways Podcast.
Yeah.
You can also send us an email. The email address is thinkingsidewayspodcast@gmail.com. That's great for feedback of any kind. And you can find us pretty much anywhere. Where you're streaming us, you know where you find us.
Stitcher.
Make sure to rate and review and do all those fun things. And all of that having been said, I think we're going to go ahead and get on out of here. I'm going to drink a lot to feel less depressed about this story.
Vroom, vroom.
Yeah. Yeah, really. Zoom, zoom. Next week, kids. Bye.
Bye.
See you in Sturgis.